begin our time of teaching this morning with an invitation to close your eyes and bow your heads for a moment of quiet, or whatever you would like to do with your body to bring yourself to stillness and quiet. And hear these words. Floods of chaos will never have the last word, and you will never be forgotten. And hear them again. Floods of chaos will never have the last word, and you will never be forgotten. Amen. Well, we began to see last week in the first part of the story of Noah and the flood that at this point in what we might think of as redemptive history, there's a very deep grief in God. Not the anger that we might have expected, you know, kind of a flailing around anger, but a very deep grief in God. But we see also what Travis was just helping us with in worship, that God is also the self-abandoning, covenant-making God who never gives up on his creation. And so I just want to help us think for a few minutes this morning about what can this mean for us in our own practical discipleship to Jesus. So the first thing is, we read in the text this morning that God remembered Noah. Now, this doesn't mean like, oh my gosh, I almost forgot. You know, oh yeah, Noah, that flood thing I got going. It doesn't mean that. Remembered here, the kind of Hebrew relational concept behind it means something like this. That there was a resolve in God's heart to fashion a new start for creation, a new beginning for humanity. And so the word remember, the connotation is an act of gracious engagement. So it could really be translated something more like God re-engaged with Noah. And he re-engaged on the basis of this covenant, that he and Noah had this partnership and they would be cooperative friends. And this is your first hint about your own discipleship. That fundamentally, to be walking with God, to be in relationship with God, means to be his cooperative friend. Now, this never reduces you to a tool on God's tool bench. This never reduces you to a rake out in the garage. The heart of the word covenant is relational. It's deeply personal. And we don't have time for, you know, technical theology here this morning, but it's important to know there's only one covenant. And it gets renewed, and different people get in on it, and there's different sort of eras of what God's doing, and there's leaders of those eras like Noah and Abraham and Moses. And so this covenant gets renewed when Israel goes into exile. And so you read covenant language throughout all the scriptures, but all that covenantal language rolls up into one thing, a relationship between God and his people. And if you ever wonder what that means, while it means most fundamentally a relationship, it means you're in relationship with somebody who's up to something, and he invites you into that which he's up to as his cooperative friend. Never thinking that he would use you, but that you would experience the best good you could ever experience, that you would be humanity as God intended, to the degree that you joyfully find all the aspects of your life finding their coherence around what it means to be God's people doing what he's doing. This is what it means when it says God blessed Noah. When God said, I establish my covenant with you, he wasn't saying, look, dope, you're going to come do what I'm doing, whether you like it or not. This isn't God, you know, talking to the way we talk to our teenagers. Well, why can't I dress like that? Because I told you. And I'm the boss here. This isn't that kind of thing. God blessed Noah and said, Noah, your highest blessing is to be a covenant partner with me. And God does this. God blesses Noah, knowing that, as our text said, every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood. And all the terrors of water didn't change that, right? Have you not found evil in your heart since childhood? And so even the terror of this flood didn't change human beings' hearts. What did we learn last Sunday? Changed God's heart. God relented. But God also gave no ground in his project. I mean, if you lay the Genesis charge to Adam and Eve side by side with the charge to Noah, the charge to Noah, what we might call recreation here, is actually more robust than the charge given to Adam and Eve. So God gives no ground. He is not ceding any ground at his intention to have a group of people or his cooperative friends, his people. And so in doing this, God further risks his own heart. And we begin to see how costly is the covenantal love of God. And of course, as the writer of Hebrews says, we see how costly it is for the final time, or in the most magnificent example of it, in the giving of his one and only son, that whoever would trust in him, who would ever come to believe that covenantal partnership with God is God's best for me, and would come to trust that, rely on it, cling to it as their meaning for life, these people would not only have life in this life, but more life and more life to come with God in eternity. Jesus then is the final revelation of this self-abandoning God. And this is what the poem or the song of Philippians 2 is celebrating. And so I want you to put this together. I know you've heard this passage from Philippians, most of you, 100 times. But I want you to put it together now, maybe for the first time in this big story. Jesus made himself nothing. He is in that moment the spitting image of this self-abandoning, risk-taking God giving himself again to a creation that he knows remains every inclination of their heart evil from childhood. And God gives himself to that situation. He puts himself in it. And so Jesus is just the highest and best representation of that, taking on the nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, humbling himself, being obedient to death, even death on a cross. Why? Well, here's another passage you've heard 1,000 times. And I want you to put it together in this story, Matthew 6. So don't worry. We just got done saying, your love never fails. It never gives up. You never give up on me. Even when you see that every inclination in my heart from child is bad, you never give up on me. Jesus is not here mouthing platitudes. You need to hear this. Jesus is describing reality as it actually is. That people who are in covenant relationship with God actually have nothing to worry about. He has invested his whole self in this project. This is what Jesus is teaching. Don't worry saying, what do we eat? What do we drink? What shall we wear? Now listen to the logic of Jesus. Those are the kind of things that pagans worry about. When you're living outside of the covenant of God, when you're living according to the intentions or the inclinations of your twisted heart, well, then, yeah, I guess you have to worry about things, those kinds of things, but not for the people who are God's people, who are living in covenant with him. They don't have to worry about those things. So then just seek ye first his kingdom. See, how many times have you read that? Some of us in this room are old enough to have sung it. But Jesus wasn't giving us a song to sing. He was giving us a reality. He was demonstrating and teaching and embodying in his way of being a reality that he was inviting us to enter into. Seek ye first the kingdom of God. And kingdom is basically New Testament language for something that's very akin to covenant. Seek the sphere in which God rules and reigns. Everything else will be given to you. This, my dear friends, is a standing invitation to a generative life. Seek ye first the kingdom of God. And not only will our generative God give you everything you need, but you will find yourself living a generative life, a life that others experience as for their good out of the overflow of your life. And then God simply says, you can be really sure about this. I'm going to give you a sign. I'm going to set this rainbow in the clouds. And so though now God is marked by hurt and grief, he resolves to stay committed to his plan and to have a harmonious, creative creation. This is what God was always shooting for. Creation that was harmonious, unified, obedient, and itself creative. And so he says, you can be assured of what we've been singing. Creation is never again abandoned to the chaos of its rebellion. And this then assures humanity that God is taking as his vocation. Try to picture this. Like, you know, somebody might ask you, well, what do you do? What's your vocation? Well, I'm a teacher, or I'm a counselor, or I do finance, or whatever. Hear God saying, well, this is what I do. I have unlimited patience and forbearance. And out of that, I am consistent and resilient in my work with humankind. So I want to say something to you this morning that I hope will not merely be enlightening, but deeply useful. You know, my early life was totally devoted to athletics and the vision that went along with that. I studied business in college, leadership to be precise, and learned all about the importance of vision casting and the task of leadership. I've taught on vision casting and leadership all over America for decades. And vision is always, we always teach people to root your vision in a preferable future. That's what you're doing. Leaders are always articulating this preferable future that they see and that others can't see, and they're calling themselves to it. Fair enough. I actually have a big beef with that. But in the Bible, vision does not begin with the preferable future. In the Bible, vision begins with the person of God. You can know, he's saying to Noah. You can know that this is okay because I'm showing you my character. The vision that animated Noah had little to do with teak wood and water. It had to do with a vision of the reliability of God. Your love never fails. It never gives up. You're never going to abandon us. This is what fuels the best and brightest vision, is something that has its origin in God and in his plan. And so his plan to give Noah a role in saving creation flowed first and foremost from Noah's vision of God. Are you feeling me here? There was something for Moses to do. That's the Sunday school story we tell each other all the time. He had to build the boat exactly to the dimensions, blah, blah, blah. So there was something for Noah to do. Of course, a vision began to emerge in his mind and how the boat might look and be shaped. But that was not the fundamental animating issue. The fundamental animating issue was the character of God himself, who out of his goodness gave Noah a role to play in what he was doing. But as I said, never utilitarian. You're never reduced to a tool in God's shed. But if you're wondering, where can I get a vision that's adequate to fund a life of followership of Jesus? It begins in the person and character of God. Not in what you might be or become, not in what you might later do. That will all be caught up into an adequate vision of God's person. But the reverse, I got to tell you, is not true. I don't know how many Christian leaders I've known over the last four decades who have very powerful visions of what they want to do, but any kind of connectedness to God and his character easily begins to fall off. So the one does not catch God up into it automatically. But the one that's funded by God and his person will just sort of suck up into it like a vacuum, whatever it is that he's asking you to do. So we begin to see here in this story how really what a costly commitment this is to God. The famous Old Testament theologian Walter Brueggemann put it this way, that the God-world connection, you looking at me here? The God-world connection, or the God-world relation, is not simply that of a strong God to a weak and needy world. It's the tortured relation of a grieved God and a continually resistant world. This is what actually is. This is why the prophets so frequently said things like, there's nothing in Israel worth saving. Their hearts are of stone. They cannot change. I mean, the prophets are full of this kind of language. Every other page, full of this kind of language. This resistant people and this grieved and hurting God. But this is also what the prophets assured. Fear not, for I am your God. Do you hear the relationality in that? It doesn't say, fear not, I've called you to be salt and light, which they had been. But that's never God's first thought. God's first thoughts are never mechanistic, never utilitarian, never using you. His first thoughts are always relational. But I am your God, and I am with you. So be not dismayed. I've called you by name, and you are mine. So you have this pain, grieved heart, and this ongoing resistant creation, and God risks his own heart hanging in there out of relational love. So the floods of chaos will indeed never have the last word. The last word belongs to the one who stands outside of and presides over the flood. Did you catch that? Chaos never has the last word. Even the chaos was God's chaos. The one who has the last word stands over all that and presides over it. And his last word is this: I will always remember my covenant. And you will never be forgotten. That's the last word. Not the chaos of our lives. Now, I'm sure people would say, well, come on, are you sure, Todd? Isn't there anything that could cause us to be forgotten? And the answer is no. You are known from eternity, and you will be known for eternity. And that God has relented and chosen to bear our pain in order to know the joy of having cooperative friends. And I just want to say to you flat out this morning, you are told in every other setting but this one, a pack of lies all day, every day. Your phones, your TVs, your everything, billboards, relationships, you are told a pack of lies all day, every day. And in response to that pack of lies, we medicate the pain of it. We try to distract ourselves from it. But the truth of it is, you were known from eternity past. The psalmist said, you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. When God was calling Jeremiah, he doesn't call him first as a tool in the shed. He says, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. I had relationship with you. Yes, you're going to be set apart and called to be a prophet, but I knew you. You can be sure that you'll never be forgotten from eternity past. And from eternity to come, the very end of the story, Revelation 21, John sees a new heaven and a new earth, and he says, I heard this great voice coming out of heaven saying, behold, God is with men. When it's all said and done, there's such an adequate word here, but I just can't say it in public. When all the crap of history is done, from Adam and Eve to Cain and Abel to the flood to whatever happens between now and Revelation 21, when it's all said and done, God is with humans. You will never be forgotten. The chaos of your life or the chaos of human life will never have the last word. They will be my people, John heard God say, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. So all throughout human history, God continually says, I'm with you, I'm with you, I'm with you. And along with it, though, comes the evangelistic question, are you with me? In your flood of chaos, can you create a little island of candor that says, okay, God, this is the real me, and I want to know and interact with the real you? And Jesus said, you can do it. I'm in solidarity with you. This is my covenant. This is the covenant. The one covenant that all there is in the Bible is one covenant.
And Jesus said, as you eat of this bread and drink of this cup, you will be nourished in relationship with God. You will become humanity as God intended as you eat and drink in faith, making relationship with God, who then makes you to be humanity as God intended. This table teaches you. Chaos never has the last word, and you will always